Welcome to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. I'm your host, Christina Frazier. In tonight's conversation, former Kansas City Star music and dance critic Paul Horsley will discuss the vital role that professional art criticism plays in maintaining the strength and vibrancy of a city's culture. A former professor and current performing arts editor at the KC Independent, Horsley will explain how media companies have changed the way they operate, reducing less profitable arts and culture coverage, resulting in a less creative community. Our show was recorded on February 18th at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church here in Kansas City, Missouri. Our show's format begins with our speaker's presentation, followed by a short break, and then concludes with the question and answer part of the program. Thanks for tuning in. Now let's join the conversation here at 90.1 FM, KKFI.
Good morning. I'm Michael Duffy, a member of the All Souls UU Forum. It's the Forum's mission to afford a platform for the discussion of significant issues, especially those which involve ethical values in the contemporary world. This morning, I'm pleased to introduce to you Paul Horsley, speaking on the subject of professional artistic criticism. Paul is a performing arts editor at the Independent in Kansas City and is the former music and dance critic for the Kansas City Star. Please welcome Paul Horsley.
Thank you very much for having me. Delight to be here. And I'd like to start by asking three questions. First of all, if we really believe that our democratic systems cannot function without the Fourth Estate serving as a watchdog, and I think that most people with a modicum of education do believe that, whatever feelings we may have about the current state of the media and their quality, then why shouldn't we hold arts organizations similarly accountable? Because they are, after all, nonprofit organizations that function like churches through the tax-free grace of you and I, you and me, the taxpayers. Interesting side note, the Fourth Estate is called that, is kind of an old-fashioned term for the press. The other two being nobility, the church, and commoners. So it's a little bit of a, and now there's a fifth estate, you know, that's everything other than established mainstream media. I hope maybe there'll be a sixth, maybe that'll be our salvation. Second, what happens to members of arts audiences when they no longer have an objective professional observer of the art forms of which they are potential consumers? No one to scrutinize, experts to advocate for their interests, who recommend the good and the bad, who investigate how arts dollars are spent, whether responsibly or not, often in open opposition to what the arts organizations themselves want you to know. And third, if professional arts criticism is no longer supported by daily newspapers and to some extent magazines, which has been its means of support primarily for the last century and a half, at least in America, then who will serve as the full-time arts watchdogs of the future? And who do we trust to write and speak out with authority about these subjects? Who will pay their salaries, salaries that are sufficient to live a decent life, to put kids through school, to buy a modest home, to retire in something other than poverty? So let me start by talking about the concept of the public trust and how nonprofits function. I don't have answers to any of those three questions, by the way, just to let you know up front. But so I'll answer by asking more questions. What if we were to live, for example, in a city where the local symphony orchestra, an organization with an eight-digit budget, played a gigantic milestone of the symphonic repertoire for the first time in its 100-year-plus history, and played it so well that it actually helped us kind of redefine the way we think about that orchestra. And the local newspaper offered no response at all. Or what if we were to live in a city where that same orchestra opened its season with a soloist who played abominably. There may be a reason why I stumbled over that word. Maybe I'm not supposed to say it. Not to mention that the artist didn't even try to stay with the conductor, and that the only response in the local newspaper was to call it jaw-dropping. Actually, on reflection, that is possibly a good description. My jaw was dropping, too, maybe for a different reason. What if our city saw a struggling new black repertory theater trying to survive? They couldn't seem to find funding because there were no major publications drumming home to us on a regular basis. The fact that our city didn't have something that almost every other city that I can think of has. B, the importance of the repertory that we hardly ever get to see. And what if organizations were unsuccessful so far in trying to raise the funds they need through social media, which has been their primary. This is all theoretical, mind you. What if? Or what if we lived in a state, for example, where a new governor could dismiss a decision that the legislature had already made to contribute nearly $50 million toward building a downtown campus for the conservatory, thus undercutting private funding that had already been pledged, and thereby virtually destroying the project. What if? And what if the only response in the daily newspaper so far were to be a finger-wagging 500-word editorial? Or finally, what if we lived in a nation which the president called to eliminate the National Endowment for the Arts, whose entire annual budget of $142 million doesn't even come close to the cost of a single presidential inauguration, which costs between, according to the Washington Post, between $175 and $200 million. Not the first president to have theoretically called for the elimination of this tiny little symbolic organization. Well, guess what? We do live in that city, as you may have guessed by now. And we do live in that state, some of us, and we do live in that country. Not long ago, cities of any size had 2, 3, 4 major competing newspapers. As revenues diminished, corporate entities took over the papers. Sometimes a morning and an evening paper would remain, which were able to capture different moments in different things happening, events happening at different times of day before they went to bed. Then those merged into, were often part of the same company, even though they tried to theoretically keep two different newsrooms, as was the case here in Kansas City, the Star and the Times. And then, of course, eventually they were all bought out by giant chains, Gannett, Knight Ridder, Scripps Howard, the Tribune, companies that traded on the stock exchange, so that it all basically came about one thing, which was two-digit profit margins all the time. It's true that privately owned newspapers had problems of their own, both politically and philosophically. If they were owned by a family that had particular political leanings, you had to deal with whether that was influencing the bias of the newspaper. In fact, the families were often among the fat cats, the power brokers in town, which is why they were an estate, as it were, the fourth estate. But they mostly understood. They entered this field because they were passionate about quality journalism, ethical journalism, and even though they may have been had political views of their own, they understood the objectivity of the newsroom and the reporters had to have. In fact, when I was growing up, we used to joke that most of the owners of newspapers were Republicans or conservatives, let's say, and most of the newsrooms were more on the liberal side, and they kind of left each other alone for the most part because they understood the importance of that. So that's where fake news comes in, you know. But the good part of private ownership was that companies, smaller companies, were satisfied with 9%, 7% profit margins. And they knew that they could have more. They could do more muckraking. They could put provocatively dressed ladies on the front cover every day and have higher profits, maybe. But when Gannett began to gobble up papers and they could boast profits of 20, 22% and more, then other companies felt a lot of pressure from their shareholders to match that. They weren't satisfied with a mere 18% profit margin. Knight Ridder was one of the last bastions. We didn't realize it at the time, but they were actually one of the good guys. And we didn't realize that until McClatchy bought them and we realized just how bad it could get. And the reason I'm talking so much about newspapers is because there is so much, that's been so much the support of, financial support of criticism, arts criticism, for all of our lives, pretty much, until recently. Then came the digital age and the end of the newspaper as we know it, the era of free news. And that's what... That's a dilemma we find ourselves in now. Who's going to pay for the news? Nobody was ready for the speed with which the bottom would drop out of the economics of newspapers. It happened too fast for anyone to be ready for it or to have a business plan or business model in mind. And really, no one's figured that out yet. We've been in the digital age now for 20 years or more, and we still haven't figured out how to make up for those big giant... It's not just the big giant Macy's full-page ads, which were important. You know, you could sell those for 20 grand. It was the classified ads that completely disappeared almost overnight because people went elsewhere online for their classified, if they went to eBay or wherever they were looking for a job, or jobs.com. They went to cars.com if they wanted to buy a car. Everything was niche-oriented, and they didn't need the newspaper anymore. When I started at the Kansas City Star in 2000, there were 10 professional critics. Most people have a hard time remembering a time. Full-time critics, 10 of us, all of whom actually earned enough salaries to put kids through college. Essentially, two full-time arts editors, a dedicated AME assistant managing editor for features and arts, and a whole army of copy editors and page designers devoted exclusively to the arts and entertainment. Now there's one full-time critic left. Poor soul, Tim Finn, workhorse. Bless his heart. There are no arts editors. There's very little freelancing. Late last year, the Star quietly decided it would no longer send reviewers. They didn't say this out loud, but there are people in this room that can attest that this is true. They decided they weren't going to send freelancers to classical music or dance anymore, unless there was some compelling reason. Once in a while, maybe if Denzel Washington was going to narrate the Lincoln portrait, they might send somebody. So gone was Robert Trussell. And let me just name a few of these to remember. If I can reminisce about the Halcyon days for a moment. Who knew not just everything about... I mean, he's not gone. Don't get me wrong. He's still alive and well and with us. He not only knew everything about theater, he knew everything about the people who worked in theater, about the history of the companies, how they'd been born. He had a budget that sent him to New York a couple times a year. He could see all the new shows. When Peter Altman decided to hire leads from outside Kansas City, Bob wrote an extensive series of articles about it, in which he interviewed people at the Rep, people, local actors who felt disenfranchised. He traced the whole history of the birth of the Actors Theater And when it was formed, it was partly because of the public awareness that Bob had helped engender as a result of just staying on this story doggedly. And Actors Theater has been going for 13 years now. I don't need to tell most of you that it's among several great theater companies that have thrived, and I think largely because of the kind of coverage that they got. But we'll come back to that issue in a minute. Gone was Bob Butler. Now, Bob still freelances for the Star, mostly on theater, but he doesn't write about movies much, for the Star, who was in his chair every morning at 8:30 at the very latest, and stayed until they had to go see screenings of two or three movies in the afternoon, who was, in my view, after Roger Ebert, the late, great Roger Ebert, the best movie critic in the country. Bob not only wrote movie reviews, though, he covered the activities of local filmmakers, some of whom were able to complete their projects precisely because they had received the coverage in the paper that was read by tens of thousands of people. Gone was Alice Thorson, a champion of the private gallery scene, which was burgeoning in the 1990s and early aughts, has essentially created the phenomenon that we now call the Crossroads. She covered the Nelson, yes, though I think she and the Kemper. She covered when the Kemper accidentally bought some fake O'Keeffe's. But she also covered these smaller galleries whose content was often outstripped, exceeded in quality what they were able to make financially viable. And so in those days, you'd be amazed what a big, gorgeous front page story about your work, you know, on the A&E section. Maybe it was a crazy modern art, but it drew people to galleries and they started coming, and First Fridays became a thing. And that was largely because people found out about it from Alice's dogged coverage. Gone was the late, great John Mark Eberhardt, full-time book editor. God rest his soul. A man who could read a book faster than anyone I've ever met. He'd get the advance of the new 1,200-page Harry Potter book in the afternoon. He'd read it in the evening, have a cogent, eloquent, strongly argued review to the editors by the wee hours of the morning so that it could go in the next day's paper. Who does that? But that's the way we did it back in the days before a 24-hour news cycle. It had to be in by midnight at the latest, theoretically. Gone was Lauren Chapin, God rest her soul, who was one of the most sophisticated restaurant critics that I knew, who could visit a restaurant two or three, four times and with companions and would have a solid, fair review of a restaurant on the basis of a comprehensive knowledge, not just of the menu, but of the chef, his staff, the owner, the menu, of course, and even the wait staff. And gone was Aaron Barnhart, who was already a famous TV online critic, who had a website before anybody had websites back in the day, tvbarn.com, which is now dead. That was a critical period for television, too, when HBO and other, it was actually before Amazon, but some of the other groups were creating shows that were better than the networks. And he became a bit of a star in the TV world and brought attention to Kansas City as a result of that. Gone was Calvin Wilson. Anybody remember him? Full-time jazz critic, essentially, wrote about the jazz scene. Who has that? Nobody else. But New York had that at the time, I think. And who's very gifted, and still is. He writes in St. Louis now. Profiles of musicians and their struggle. Gone was Brian McTavish, who wrote some of the most wildly entertaining interviews with celebrities, which not only entertained local audiences, but went out on the wire services, what used to be the closest thing to the net we had, and they were read by millions on the AP and the Knight Ridder wires. And first out the door was Paul Horsley, who I was first out, they said, because I had been last hired. It sounded nice. I was ready to accept that. Who, together with colleagues on the business and the downtown development desks, Kevin Collison, Mark Couch, Steve Paul, had doggedly followed the progress and sometimes criticized the unfolding of the Performing Arts Center as it was being developed for more than 10 years, seeing it through to completion in something like the form that it was intended, though not quite. If I had been around a little bit longer to fight, the PAC might now have that third concert hall that most people don't remember was supposed to be attached to the east end of that, a 500-seat theater that was part of the original plan. When around 2009, the center was thinking of abandoning the project on the hillside altogether, rehabbing the old Lyric Theater and building a second facility in that parking lot next door. So we wrote several very strongly worded articles and columns and editorials about what a stupid idea that was. I wrote articles which I spoke to people who had just built performing arts centers, and they said, if you downsize it, you're going to regret it for the next 100 years. And some people were actually willing to go on record saying that, which is rare. And poof, overnight, Moshe Safdie's iconic hillside structure was back on the table. I'm not taking credit for that. I'm just saying that this is what I underestimated was the power of the press at that time. So once the Star eliminated 9 of its 10 critics, successively one by one, the first reaction from arts groups was one of outrage, consternation, indignation. And to be fair, they at least recognized the importance of coverage they've been getting and were afraid of not getting it. As one of them said, we believe it is utmost importance that the classical music and dance position be filled. Adding, however, we're not saying necessarily that it should be Paul Horsley. So they had mixed feelings about it. And as time went by, arts groups realized that the freelancers who were being sent to review the performances were not necessarily ill-informed, but they didn't have the history of these organizations that they were covering. They didn't know where a single performance fit into the whole picture of theater, of classical music, of dance, and mostly because some of them, the default mode was to write the nice things and leave out the critical things. Reviews got nicer. And suddenly the arts groups thought, well, this is not such a bad idea after all. And now that the brochure suddenly, instead of being festooned with quotes from the press, were now festooned with comments they'd gathered from audience members in the foyer after the concert. I had a great time at this concert, said so-and-so. Because there were no authoritative quotes from authoritative newspapers. The next thing that happened was that some of the former critics at the Star began to write for smaller publications, including the one I write for now, where they could be frank again, theoretically, about the achievements or lack thereof of the arts groups. And again, arts leaders regarded this with consternation. But guess what? The readership of these publications, it turns out, instead of tens of thousands, are numbering in the hundreds. So the arts groups breathe a sigh of relief again because nobody was reading. So last man standing, Tim Finn, bless his heart, one of the last great rock critics in the USA. I don't know if people realize the amazingly comprehensive knowledge this guy has of rock, pop, country, rap, hip-hop, everything else he's covered. He's a workhorse, too. Lady Gaga one day, Tech N9ne the next, Bruno Mars one day, Dolly Parton the next. And he writes authoritatively about all of these people. If Miley Cyrus does a cover of Roy Orbison, which she did, by the way, Tim can tell you the whole history of everybody else who's covered that song. and compare Miley's to theirs. I mean, that is what a professional critic looks like. Which brings me to my second point, which is, what does a professional critic look like? And why does it matter? First and foremost, I think that critics are historians. You know, we used to talk about how journalists in general are historians. We're the people who are doing the investigation have similar backgrounds often to historians in the sense that we look for, we vet sources. We don't just accept something that someone has told us. We're the first draft of history. When people are writing history, what are the things they do? They go back to newspapers. When I write about 18th century music, I go back and read what people were writing in the 18th century. And that's the only reason how we know that, you know, what Mozart did in a concert. If there hadn't been a press in those days, we would not know that sometimes people clapped between movements, for example, of a symphony, or even during a movement of a symphony or a concerto. If they liked a particular lick that he'd done, they would applaud, just like in jazz. When we learn things like that, we think, oh, well, so maybe we shouldn't be so hard on people who clap between movements. But I still think it's a bad idea. But first and foremost, I believe that a journalist needs to be, and so sort of an outgrowth of that, is needs to have a degree in journalism. Call me old-fashioned, but that's not enough. And there's where it gets fuzzy, because each critic I know has come to their area of expertise through a somewhat different route. I think in general, you, the reader, have a right to expect, though, the kind of expertise that in an arts critic that you would find in someone who writes about business, who someone writes about the stock market or legislatures or sports. At the Star, I had colleagues with law degrees decided not to practice law because they wanted to cover law for journalism as journalists. And who better to write about legislatures, which are basically made up of a bunch of lawyers, than someone who knows the law? I had colleagues who had run and owned businesses. I had colleagues who played professional sports. In previous generations, and until recently, in fact, arts critics themselves were practicing artists. I started out as a pianist. I'm not a failed pianist. I just decided not to play piano because I liked writing about it better. We had, in music, which is my main area, we had Virgil Thompson, who wrote about composers at the same time he was himself writing music and was a composer. Now, you could talk about problems of conflict of interest there. You could talk about who his favorites were and whether they were friends of his, or in the case of a woman of hers. But at least these are not a bunch of old men who couldn't make it in their field and sort of decided to take out their bitterness by criticizing everybody. Some of the most astute writers I know, actually, are those who have training as journalists and have a professional experience and or a degree. If you need a PhD to write about, or a law degree to write about your subject in the best way, in the most responsible way possible, then go get it. So a critic is ideally a person with the expertise to recognize why a performance or artwork doesn't work or doesn't click, but also one who has the writing skills to convey to a general public what happened, to elucidate something that you might have felt was missing but were not completely able to articulate. And I have that same experience sometimes. I go to something and I'm not quite sure, and I'll read someone who was there and actually is maybe more astute about that topic, and I say, that makes sense. That's why it didn't work. That expertise is transferable. And in fact, many of my former colleagues at the Star now work in PR. But every time a critic becomes a PR flack, the public loses. And as the newspaper business has collapsed, we find more and more that this has become almost a natural transition. I was just telling Michael that a recent critic whom I respect highly, Tim Mangan, was one of the last remaining full-time classical music critics, worked for the Orange County Register. Well, when his position was eliminated, the symphony orchestra in town, the Pacific Symphony, hired him on as their writer in residence. Seemed like a perfectly natural transition. You could go and basically write similar stories to what you were writing before, profiles of artists, etc. With one exception, all the negative parts have been removed. He can't say anything bad about the symphony. And if you're the executive director of that organization, you're thinking, problem solved. No more negative critiques. As a matter of fact, if you grill the leaders of arts organizations, you will find that a surprising number of them believed and still believe that the local press should be on their side, that they should, in a community sense, as one arts leader said to me once, get on board with what we're trying to do. Well, I understand this, you know. I used to work for an orchestra. I understand the challenges of nonprofits. And when I switched and began to be a critic, I realized that we were kind of on the same side, you know. We who love the arts are kind of in one camp, and the Philistines, if you'll pardon the old term, are on the other, philosophically. But my first allegiance is not to either the arts organization or my newspaper, it's to you all, it's to the readers. And I need to serve the reader who is the consumer of that organization, who has to pay 100, we were just talking about the prices of the organizations that moved into the Performing Arts Center. They promised that they wouldn't go up too much. Well, now it costs about $125 for a single ticket to the opera. Not to pick on the opera, the ballet costs the same. To take a family of four to the Nutcracker costs about $500 now. And I had colleagues at the Star, even before I left, who said, I want to take my kids. And I looked at the prices. They don't have discounts for kids. They don't have senior discounts. As one arts leader said to me, we can't offer senior discounts. That would be almost all of our entire audience. But there is currently one or possibly two full-time dance critics. There are now, to take an extreme example, two full-time dance critics in the entire nation. There used to be three, but then the LA Times eliminated theirs. So now we have one guy at the New York Times who happens to be a Brit, but is fortunately very astute and writes very intelligently, and a woman who I think is full-time at the Washington Post, who's also quite good at what she does. There are about six or eight full-time classical music critics in the country left. There were 75. Scott Cantrell, my predecessor at the Star, kept count. He said about 25 years ago when he first started in the field, there were about 75 full-time critics who would come to meetings, and they actually had annual conferences, and there are now about, he says 10, I think it's more like 8. And in theater, there's probably 20, 25 full-time critics left. A generation ago, there were dozens and dozens, maybe hundreds. What impact will this have on the future of the arts? That's really the critical question. Well, without having to generalize, I can tell you right now, it's already having an impact on Kansas City as we sit here. And I welcome your comments on this. You may not agree, but I believe that unlike the artistic ferment here in the 90s and aughts, in this city, which also saw tremendous downtown development, culture in Kansas City is stagnating. I'll say that again. Culture in Kansas City is stagnating. Performing arts groups are offering fewer and fewer really challenging works. Experimental theater is a thing of the past. Experimental dance, forget it. We used to have Merce Cunningham's company come every couple of years, or Paul Taylor. We used to have choreographers who threw themselves against walls and things. The ballet does big story ballets now, Dracula, Alice in Wonderland, Peter Pan. That's fine. But they also sell, and they help the bottom line, and that's important. but we don't see nearly as much experimental dance as we used to. Smaller companies, smaller dance companies in particular, are withering on the vine. There are several worthy ones. One is called Sterling Dance. It's out, based out in Olathe. They do a program they call Underground, which when it was first premiered, I wrote was one of the most important full-length ballets that I had seen in many, many years. And when it came to do the top 10 events of the decade, I actually selected them. I think they were number 10, but you know they had a lot of competition among the large organizations. Well, that was 8 or 9 years ago. They still use that quote in there because nobody else has written anything else about them since then. The Kansas City Symphony presents about 85% standard European fare. I have nothing against that. In fact, I happen to have a Beethoven biography right here. Though, to be fair, they have 3 women on the program, women composers, on their program for next season, which is bucking a national trend. There are lots and lots of women composers now, but they have yet to break it into the major orchestra scene. I think the Philadelphia Orchestra, for example, is offering 0 women on its season next year. The Lyric Opera presents, as part of what it considers out there, edgy contemporary fare, they offer a 17-year-old opera that's been around for a long time, been performed a lot, which is a shameless copy of a Sean Penn movie. It was okay, but we'd seen it before. Dead Man Walking, I'm talking about. So my final point is whither, and that's with an H, whither professional criticism or whither. If I may come back, circle back to Eric Greitens. Is he here today, by the way? I want to temper my comments, or any member of his staff. When he vetoed the $48 million in matching state funds toward making the UMKC Conservatory into a player on the national stage, he wrote the following and was quoted, "Politicians passed a bill that would put taxpayers on the hook for $75 million. Well, that was wrong to begin with. He didn't understand the idea of matching funds, but anyway. To build and run a conservatory for dancers and art students. Now, somebody in Eric's office might have told him that they don't teach art at the UMKC Conservatory, but that's the Art Institute, that thing right over there. But, and maybe if he'd paid a visit to Kansas City once in a while, he'd know that, but I'd prefer he didn't anyway. But... And maybe I'm being too hard on the governor. Maybe there's new hope there's hope with our new chancellor, Agrawal, who seems committed to finding the money for this and other projects. But when one person can go against the will of the people, the legislature, who've been voted for by voters, how do we as a community fight for this? I can guarantee you that if this were 1999 and the Star still had 10 full-time writers about the arts, we would be writing about this every day. We'd be writing about the NEA every week. We'd be writing about the tepid arts seasons every single day until the organization got so sick of us they just relented and did what we told them to, which is our goal ultimately. But if I may conclude with an upbeat message, I will say this. First of all, I do believe that there is hope for the future of criticism of the arts, and I think that it's tied to the future of professional journalism, which I don't think is dead. And I don't think that the future is necessarily in social media, although I don't frown on that as a means of critiquing. In fact, the brevity of tweets actually I thought was good for journalists because it taught us that you could actually write a review in 140 characters if you wanted to and say pretty much everything you needed to say, as my editors were always telling me, shorter, shorter, shorter. And I do believe that there's, call me a ridiculous optimist if you will, but I think that we might be experiencing a temporary paroxysm, if I'm using that word correctly, of perversity, and that this will pass. I think the Americans are going to start wising up. They're going to begin demanding more and responsible and better journalism in general. I think, you know, what is a reliable source? Young people are eventually going to start asking, how do I know who to believe? You know, I can't believe Facebook anymore. The Russian infiltration into our social media might have done us all a favor. Maybe it will send us running back to the professional critics who are trained to vet sources with relentless vigor, people who don't accept received secondhand information as fact. And gradually, websites, instead of newspapers perhaps, will begin to find revenue sources, will begin to find business models. I sort of had hope for this a few years ago that organizations, that groups like Huffington Post were going to become the new newspapers and they would find a way to make money. But there's still a lot of people writing for these organizations for free. There's a positive aspect to there not being just one person who writes about theater having undue influence, in the sense that now that there are several blogs and websites, you may have three or four different opinions. But you don't know who those people are. You don't know whether they have, and almost none of them have journalism training. And they're only read by a few hundred people at best. So none of them can really have the impact that the large newspaper has. Some people say it's a good thing. Some people in the arts say having a diversity of opinion is great. In the old days, of course, you know, cities like this had four or five different newspapers, and each of them had their own critics. So you could actually, you know, the old cliche in the 30s, after the new theater work was premiered, they would wait up for the papers, and they'd get four or five different newspapers and read, compare the reviews. But that day is not here yet. If we all continue to insist on it, we might live to see that day. I think it's especially important for the arts, because if anything, in this fractured world is going to bring us together, it's art. But it's only going to happen if there are professional critics, journalists, people writing about it, nudging it, pushing it toward greatness. Why the arts? Well, here's one take on Beethoven, to talk about an old dead white guy for a moment, if I may, written by one of the more eloquent scholars, biographers of our time, Maynard Solomon. You know, Beethoven got, oh, I was using this as a bookmark, my old lanyard from the Star. I used to be able to get into anywhere with this. Now that it's faded. People criticized Beethoven's use of Schiller's Ode to Joy in the Ninth Symphony because they said it after the horrors of the 20th century, it spoke of an optimism for humanity that did not really reflect the reality. Solomon digests this and he says the following, which I think is a wonderful way of looking at this. He says, the fatal and destructive error behind such attitudes is this. If we lose our awareness of the transcendent realms of play, beauty, and brotherhood, which are portrayed, sisterhood, if you will, which are portrayed in the great affirmative works of our culture, if we lose the dream of the Ninth Symphony, there remains no counterpoise against the engulfing terrors of civilization, nothing to set against Auschwitz and Vietnam as a paradigm of humanity's potentialities. Masterpieces of art are instilled with a surplus of constantly renewable energy, an energy that provides a motive force for changes in the relation between human beings, because they contain projections of human desires and goals which have not yet been achieved, which may indeed be unachievable, but which are worth striving for. And he concludes by quoting Schiller himself, who says, talking about Beethoven, to arrive at a solution even of a political problem, the road of aesthetics must be pursued, because it is through beauty that we arrive at freedom. That may be too neat of a way to conclude, but thank you very much.
If you have questions for Paul, please come to the mic. And again, we prefer questions rather than comments, and give everybody a shot before you take your second question. I'll say first, the speaker for next week was intended to be Nick Bjornson, to talk about the historic federal tax bill that was adopted last month, but he's recently been hospitalized with a serious medical condition. So we'll have to try to hopefully reschedule that for a later date. So in lieu of that speaker, our own George Bagot will be talking next Sunday on the topic of the early days of the environmental movement, his involvement in it, hazardous waste. Should be an interesting talk. So now, please step forward to the mic, and we have about 10 minutes for questions. Go right ahead.
First off, I'd like to thank both you and Scott Cantrell for all the things you taught me about music. Music doesn't exist in a vacuum, and knowing where it came from and where it might be going is extremely important. My question is this: how can we as an arts audience deal with people like McClatchy, who proudly announced that they have two additional full-time columnists covering University of Missouri sports, which they obviously can afford, as well as the 10 people they have already covering these things, yet other than Patrick Neese's lovely page on Sunday, we have nothing. What can we do?
Thank you for that question, and it's certainly one that I've asked many times myself. You know, when I left the Star, I looked for someone to blame, because obviously I had a decent paying job. I had moved from Philadelphia here, where I had an even better paying job, to take this job because I saw this incredibly thriving arts scene here and some of the best critics I'd seen in the world. And I said, I would be honored to be a part of this team. Well, what I didn't realize was that that was just a few years from collapsing. When McClatchy bought Knight Ridder, they assured us, Gary Pruitt, I'll name him, he's now nearly a billionaire, stood in the newsroom and said that the culture will not change our values or your values. He forgot to mention that, by the way, we have to keep those profit margins up in the double digits. Well, you know, do you blame him? I can't blame my editors. They cried when they eliminated, when they told us that our positions were being eliminated. And then theirs were eventually, too. Maybe that was why they were crying. So you try to find blame when the problem is historic and institutional. And I've thought about this a lot. Sometimes it seems like if there is evil in the world, maybe it exists not so, you know, each human being has roughly the same potential for good and evil. But if where great evil presides, it is in institutions. It's in large groups that don't act as a single human being would act. They act as corporations act. Corporations, if they're people, I sure don't want to meet those people. Because corporations act in ways that are not human. McClatchy is operating like a corporation, and it will continue to. There's nothing, to answer your question, there's absolutely nothing we can do except to find alternatives that can be as viable. And sometimes, for a time, many of us entertained the idea of a nonprofit model for arts criticism. And in fact, that's sort of what some of the groups that have set up websites have tried to create, which is do fundraising. But then, of course, your fundraising, once you're no longer a commercial operation, you have your, who's giving you funds? Well, the Kauffman Foundation, the same organizations that support the groups that you're supposedly being critical of. So that runs into conflict of interest almost immediately. I think demanding, and I will say this, arts organizations have adapted to this to some extent, and I compliment them, some of them, for this, by becoming more self-critical, that they have themselves, as one executive director of a very large orchestra in this country, who had managed, and it's not here, had managed to make sure that the arts critic could no longer write about the symphony because the publisher happened to be on the symphony board. Oops, there's no conflict of interest there. Said to me on the phone once, we don't need you all to tell our stories. We'll tell our own stories. Well, that was partly a reflection of the fact that because of the economics of newspapers, there was less quality in journalism. And so, to some extent, arts organizations have been forced to tell their own stories because nobody else will tell them. But I would say, and I don't say this purely from a selfish point of view, but there are small publications here in town to work on a local basis that you can support and that you can read on a regular basis. As I said, several of the formerly full-time critics are now writing for these smaller groups. In fact, two of my favorite colleagues who used to sit literally within 3 feet of me, Alice Thorson was on one side, Bob Trussell was on the other, now run basically the arts desk, if you will, or mostly the arts coverage of KC Studio, not to plug a competitor, basically, but and they do great work. And there are some people who, in this room, actually, who freelance for them, and it's a wonderful and beautiful looking magazine. Let's support that. It's a nonprofit in a weird sort of way. It used to be the KCPT program guide combined with an arts group. Then they split. But they still write very sophisticated articles about the arts, and so it's there. I mean, there's still less coverage. It's not like being there 60 hours a week covering every single day. But there is...
More questions.
Okay. So, if that answers your question, yes.
I am just curious, and I hope this isn't too ignorant of a question, but just as a critic, how often has it been your experience that you might evaluate something one way, like right after seeing a performance or experiencing something, and then reflect back on it several years ago and decide, wow, I think I really feel differently about this, or I see this kernel and it glimmers for me anew, you know, like years later? I'm just curious if your opinions evolve, what your experience has been.
That's a brilliant question. There are no ignorant questions, only ignorant answers. The answer to that, the short answer is all the time. In fact, when we used to have to file reviews by midnight, it was a struggle. Sometimes the opera would get out at 11:30, you know, and they'd give you a few extra minutes to write. And then you didn't have to wait a few years. The next morning you'd wake up and think, oh my gosh, really, did I say that? So, but I think there is value still in the immediate response, because that's what the audience is going to have too. When they first go home, they're going to say, well, yeah, and then they're going to think about it for a while. So in the old days, we had, you know, daily papers, which had the immediate response, and then we had weeklies that had the bigger reflective articles. Having the luxury, and that's one of the advantages of these weeklies, monthlies, that now take the place, essentially, of criticism locally, is that people do have more time to reflect. You can go to performance and not have to have it in until the next day, or maybe a few days later. You can actually think about it, research it, Look on YouTube to see who else has sung that aria, or who else did that scene from Fences. There's a scene from Fences. You can watch about 10 different versions of it and then decide, well, how was ours? So it's always been a challenge, and I think in some ways we're better off with the situation we have now because people do have more of a time to reflect.
When I want to know about the arts, or what I do to keep up in general on the arts, is to listen to KCUR and KCPT. Do you see any hope in organizing around public media?
Okay. A short answer, and I regret not having brought up broadcast. Because when I was growing up, you either chose print journalism or you chose broadcasts, and they were considered like the fluffy, coiffed-haired people. Of the radio, of course, was a different creature. What we have today, though, is newspapers which actually have videos and basically have hired a bunch of people from TV to do their videos. And we have radio stations that write articles online, which are sometimes far more sophisticated and in-depth. And KCPT is actually hiring writers to write about the arts. I think that what we see is a merging of all the through the internet, all the different coverages are becoming kind of unified. And I believe that radio, even though it has public support so far, that's one of the other things that our government wants to eliminate. But definitely an example of where nonprofit money can help us, because if the reason that we don't cover the arts is because the coverage is not profitable, then let's build a nonprofit model because we believe that it's important.
We'll see you next week. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you've enjoyed tonight's presentation, Artistic Excellence, Threatened by Death of Professional Criticism, with Paul Horsley. This program was recorded on Sunday, February 18th, at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church. All Souls Forum is edited and produced for broadcast by Christina Frazier. Our theme song was composed, performed, and recorded by musician Fred Potter. This program will be available for podcast within one day of broadcast on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. Remember, you can also find archived All Souls podcasts and many other interesting and enlightening public affairs programs produced by KKFI on the KKFI website. Thanks for joining us this evening, and we hope you tune in next week, same time, same place, when we will continue the conversation here at 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City's community radio station.